Hello, I'm veterinarian Dr. Brian Greger, and you have downloaded another episode of The Vet Podcast. This is the first of two episodes discussing the history of veterinary medicine with Dr. Bruce Vivas-Jones. Bruce is a retired veterinarian, veterinary historian, and author, and has authored what is possibly the most complete account of the history of veterinary medicine published. In this first instalment, I discuss the origins of veterinary medicine as we know it, but we start some 4,000 years ago with superstition, sacrifice, and religion, with a little bit of classical history on the side.
You are listening to The Vet Podcast, presented by veterinarian Dr. Brian Greger from New Zealand. Join us as we discuss pet health issues from around the world.
I am really excited to have Dr. Bruce Vivas-Jones joining me today. Bruce is a 1951 graduate and has worked in clinical practice, both large and small animal, taught at the Veterinary College in London, worked in industry, particularly on nematode vaccines, and spent the last 37 years of his career working as an animal health consultant around the world. If that wasn't enough, after a full career, he then decided to write a book on the history of veterinary medicine. Bruce, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you, Brian.
One of the things that you have done, and I would imagine it has taken up a reasonable amount of your retirement, is you have written this wonderful book called The History of Veterinary Medicine and the Animal-Human Relationship. Now, I have to put a wee plug in for 5M Books here, who have sent me a copy of this book. It's an absolute stunner of a book, Bruce. You must have known when you started to write it that it was going to take a long time to do it. Why did you do it?
That's a good question. Well, I became interested in the history of veterinary medicine and the veterinary profession soon after I graduated. And it remained an interesting hobby. And then, because I was active in the Veterinary History Association in Britain, when the World Veterinary Association held their annual congress in Cape Town, South Africa, in 2011, which was declared World Veterinary Year, they asked me to go to Cape Town and to address the meeting on veterinary history and the role that it played in the profession. And then I had a good attendance at the meeting, and I had a lot of questions afterwards. And I thought, when I returned to England, it's high time that somebody else wrote the new history of veterinary medicine. And so I started to do it. It took me 8 years, it's approximately, that it was. And I was reminded very much of an aphorism of Winston Churchill, who was a significant author. And he said, writing is a book. First, it's quite interesting. Then it's very interesting. Then it's your mistress. Then it's your master. Finally, it's your tyrant. And it's absolutely true.
I have to admit, Bruce, that it is one hell of a book. It's thick. It's absolutely full of information. I can see why it took so long to write. Let's go to page one, and this is the very start of veterinary medicine. Where did veterinary medicine come from? Now, I am assuming veterinary medicine and domestication go hand in hand.
Yes. You know, 4,000 years ago, we have written word in Mesopotamia and in Egypt out of clay tablets in Mesopotamia and in papyrus in Egypt. There are documents which indicate that veterinary medicine was being practiced, and there were individuals who made it their speciality to work in that field. Now, for the situation in those countries, for that to have arisen meant that veterinary medicine had been going on for quite a long time. It's before that, but our first record of it is 4,000 years ago. And in each case, it indicates that the countries at that time, 4,000 years ago, had organized their structure and that they had named individuals who practiced veterinary medicine. the quality of that remorse, we find hard to judge because we don't have very much evidence. But from the evidence coming out of Egypt, veterinary medicine and human medicine were one subject. They weren't split into separate subjects. The same individual would work with animals or humans. In Mesopotamia, the same word was used for the healer as a doctor. It was Azos, and then they prefaced it by either human Azos or veterinary Azos. So there was a reasonably comprehensive structure, but in neither situation did anybody understand what caused illness or disease. And so when tragedies happened, whether they were animal tragedies, human tragedies, earthquakes, drought, they had to blame somebody, and they blamed the gods. And so they had to offer gifts for creation to the gods, which called a priestly structure to come in. And we had right from the very outset that religion played a part in the evolution of veterinary medicine.
So you would almost assume then, if you were looking at religions, and correct me if I'm wrong, there was quite a lot of ritual slaughter and sacrifice going on. They would have only wanted to have sacrificed healthy animals, I would be guessing. And when they do sacrifice them, if there was any underlying pathology when they were doing the sacrifice and eviscerating or opening up the slaughtered animal, I would be assuming that they would be noting that some animals have changes and from there moving on to the pathology.
Yeah, there are two ways of this. A lot of the animal slaughter, as you say, was taken up because they wanted to find something that would tell them of the future or of the disease or what was happening. And this is in particular examination of the liver. And we know from this clay imitation of liver that they marked it into various sectors. Now they would only use for it a divination on healthy livers. So if the animal was diseased in some way, they wouldn't use it if it slaughtered another poor animal until they found they had a healthy liver. Then they would examine that depending on the colour, the shape, the lobes, and various other things. Now, also, we have ritual slaughter, which came into religions for slaughtering food for human consumption. And this was in the Bible, first of all, in the Jewish tradition, and they slaughtered animals in a particular way, and they also laid down rules for its examination of the carcass. And from the early literature in the Bible, they probably recognized tuberculosis lesions. And if they found them in the lungs, the animal was not suitable for human consumption.
So at this time, we're talking about, I suppose you could call it the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia and the Egyptian area. What was happening in Europe?
Well, veterinary medicine in Europe, we know nothing of it at all until the information that was being generated in Egypt and Mesopotamia drifted across to the Aegean Sea, especially Greece and Turkey. And then the first known civilization in Europe happened in Crete, the Cretan civilization, and their crystallization of ideas and the first formation of a language in Europe, the written language. And then this gradually progressed in Greece, and then Greece became the civilization center of Western Europe. And then out of that, they evolved the philosophy, the names that we know of, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, etc. These men wondered where life came from, what caused life, what was going to happen, and so on. And one of the areas of the philosophy was natural philosophy. Natural philosophy became the medicine. And then certain individuals specialized in talking about that area. and then two names come up at once. First of all, Aristotle. Aristotle, whom truthfully he said to have been the first Athenian scientist. He wrote his treatise, The History of Animals. He catalogued 500 species. He recorded as having dissected at least 50 species around. And he recorded much of this information. He also recorded the horse did not have a gallbladder. And this was something that he recorded then, but was overlooked in Western Europe until about 1500 or 1600. People still sort of horses had a gallbladder. But Aristotle also documented various illnesses, the diseases that he knew. He gave names to and a brief description. We can recognize that some of them, not all of them. He wasn't a clinician. He wasn't a veterinarian. He was the first pathologist. So then with the information he was developing on the practical medical side, the first man to come up with a philosophy of human medicine was Hippocrates, Hippocrates of Cos. We don't actually know too much of what he wrote and left, but he emphasized that illness and sickness had nothing to do with the God or providence. It's certainly unrelated to any supernatural function. And the second thing he said, whatever you do, do not harm. Do not harm. And so he created a core for human medicine. Now, he never talked about veterinary medicine because he believed in Plato. Plato had said only humans have a soul. Animals don't have a soul. So Hippocrates only worked with humans because he thought working with animals was definitely lower class than anything. Over the next 200 to 300 years, a school of medicine grew up in Greece. It crystallized in Alexandria, and the Alexandrian School of Medicine, mainly human medicine, they started to find out how blood system works, how we breathe, how we eat, how food and so on. And they didn't understand circulation, but they made a lot of progress. And out of this, too, a veterinary culture grew up with specialists in the horse. The veterinary specialists in the Greek world were called hippiatri, the horse medicine. And various one of these started to create the veterinary ethic, you might say. And what comes over very clearly, like from the very earliest writings, take care of your animals. Care and their welfare come number one. Now, this is still recognized today, but unfortunately the human race has not played its part in this very well. But care for animal welfare, and then out of the early Greek authors, one man in particular, Absyrtus, who was possibly a veterinarian in the Roman cavalry. He was a Greek one, but Greece was now part of not the Roman Empire. And he started to lay out a sensible approach for looking at disease in animals. He looked at the animal in segments, he looked at the legs and the limbs, which were the primary area of interest, looked at the abdomen, looked at the head, and so on. And then he also tried to classify the diseases on the basis of their symptoms. And he laid down, you have to understand the symptom before you make the diagnosis. And when you make the diagnosis, you can start to make a prognosis. Now this was the plan that he worked through. But he also worked in a time when the belief in magic and incantation and so on. So if you read his work, it's a bit of a jumble of things. But he was the first person who sort of came out very strongly.
So at this time, you've mentioned the pathology, the diagnosis. Is there any treatment going on at this stage, or are they just putting names on what's killing their animals?
Treatment was rudimentary. I mean, they had adopted the same idea that the humans had, that there was a herb somewhere to treat everything. And they also utilized treatments of various sorts. And this, apart from herbal treatments, they used bloodletting. Bloodletting was a major factor in both human and animal treatment, because the concept was that when an animal was ill, the blood became a corrupted, and so the blood had to be drained out and let new blood come in. So there was bleeding, there was the use of herbal medication, normally given as a drench. Sometimes they would grind up and blow the ground up herb into the nostrils to hope that it would be abnormal in that way. And then also the use of cautery. They thought about firing animal, you could encourage a more rapid net cure. But there was a gradual recognition also coming that in certain diseases, you had to be very careful, take it very, very slowly, don't do anything drastic, allow rest and guidance regarding the food they have. So basic, I mean, we're talking over a period of many hundreds of years, so these things are all happening very, very gradually. And what the most important thing that happened out of the Greek world, as Greece had become part of the Roman Empire, the Romans, who ran this enormous empire all of Europe and Africa, Middle East and so on, they were a highly pragmatic race of people. They weren't awfully kind, but they were highly pragmatic. And they were able to take the Greek knowledge and then utilize that in the form of veterinary medicine. It was becoming fairly well structured. The Roman Empire rested on the Roman army, and the army rested on mules. Mules were the wagon train that helped the army move around the world. And so the treatment of mules became number one emphasis. And so the army had a recognized veterinary corps, and they laid out the treatment practices. There were also, as far as we know, because there wasn't any organized veterinary structure, there weren't any veterinary colleges or teaching, there were obviously individual veterinary practitioners around the countryside of the empire. And most of the agriculture was in large properties. Large properties employed slaves. Slaves undertook the work, and a good property owner would have one or two well-educated slaves who would look after the health of the animals. And they would have the prescriptions, herbal prescriptions, mainly for the use of water, hot water or cold water, or bathing the animal. And these men, the educated slaves, if they found they had a problem they couldn't handle, then the owner of the property would call in one of the more educated veterinary practitioners. This is a structure that we don't really understand very well. But the health of animals, by and large, in the Roman Empire, was reasonably good, except when epizootic diseases swept through. And from all the knowledge we have, certainly rinderpest, foot and mouth disease, contagious bovine pneumonia were all fairly common. And nobody could do anything with it, no treatment at all. Well, the Romans soon began to recognize that if you had a big herd, you split the herd into small groups. And so if an epizootic came, you stood a chance of not losing all of your animals. This was one of the times, the first time, that veterinary medicine was ahead of human medicine. when the epizootics got England, they all clung together in a group. Then, as the Roman Empire began to crumble towards the end, and the Roman Empire ended about 18 or 460, and Europe collapsed into a collection of small countries of fiefdoms and struggled to keep people, and the whole concept of nuclear medicine and human medicine just collapsed, and it became gradually worse and worse. And then when the epizootic started up once again, there wasn't any guiding hand anywhere to the control. And so at about the same time, the Christian Church in Rome started to establish itself throughout Europe by saying, we are taking over the moral role that Rome used to have. We aren't occupying your country, but we are offering you a religion. And the religion offered the compassion. And when the disease came, whether it was a human disease or an animal disease, the owner or the individual could find a priest who would say, I'll pray for you. This would at least have something. Nothing else was happening anyway. And so gradually, the Christian church that took over the treatment or the healing of animals and humans, but they had no treatment or healing to do, but they had prayers to do. And this inhibited any work towards trying to understand the cause of disease, because disease was the result of mankind and sinning against the word of the Lord. So medicine became in a fall to the Christian religion, which also can be traced right back to the early days of the first attempt in the Bible, where the very God could not control the problem.
So what broke veterinary medicine out of this stupor that it appeared to be in?
Well, the end of the Roman Empire saw the empire split into two parts, east and west. The Eastern Empire survived until the early 1400s. But the Eastern Empire also preserved all the ancient literature, the ancient Greek literature. It was all in manuscripts and in treatises there. When that part of the empire collapsed and the Islamic world came in and took over large sections of the Roman Empire, all of North Africa, Spain, Persian Empire. The Muslims were avid for information. They wanted to learn, and they wanted to learn that medicine. They were very interested in veterinary medicine because the horse to the early Muslims was the most valuable creature in the world. So this carried through. And then they developed veterinary medicine out of the ancient texts. But there was no religious interference, and human medicine and veterinary medicine in the years of the Islamic Empire, they ranked equally. And then as the Islamic Empire became more mature in about the 1200s, one of their major centers of civilization was in Cordoba in Spain. And they had many, many stores there in various areas, in particular human medicine and veterinary medicine. And at that time, the king of Sicily, who also controlled the areas of Italy and Germany, became interested in his animals in particular. And so he got his people to start to talk with this Muslim learned men and their treatises. And he got hold of these and had them translated into Latin. And so this was a translation of this ancient Greek work that had come into the Roman Empire, which had been totally lost to the Western world. And then the first veterinary work out of this was a book, a man called Rufus, an Italian, in the early 1400s, and then afterwards we began to get a greater growth and understanding of nuclear medicine. This progressively led up to the time of the Renaissance, and then with this Renaissance, that we had a start in university and a better understanding of knowledge. And then after that, the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment in Western Europe centered very much on France. And there was a magnificent piece of work by two men called Didymo and D'Alembret, who wrote or compiled an encyclopedia of over 30 volumes. Several years to reproduce it, and we try to put into this encyclopedia all the knowledge that we had. And one of the men who contributed much to that was a Frenchman called Paul de Bourgeois, and he was from Equestrian. He was a great horseman. He began to write about horses. He wrote over 20 articles which went into the recent encyclopedia, and then his influence began to grow because at the same time, Rinderpest swept into Europe again. And France was very concerned because the numbers of cattle were being drastically reduced over a period of 10 or 12 years, something like 200 million head of cattle died in Western Europe due to Rinderpest. But Bourgeois had a friend called Bertin, who was comptroller of the finances of the King of France, who was Louis XV. He persuaded Louis that it would be a good idea if they had a veterinary school to train veterinarians who could then look after the health of animals. This the king said it was a good idea, and Bourgeois was granted a charter, and he opened the first Ecole de Veterinary School in Lyon in France in 1761. And out of that, it grew quite rapidly, and students came from all over Europe to learn in his school. At the same time, the epidemic of Rinderpest waned somewhat, and there was an immediate belief that these students were learning how to control Rinderpest. Well, they were actually mainly learning about the horse, but what happened was that within a few years, pretty much every major country in continental Europe at the veterinary school.
So, Bruce, you can take it that this point in veterinary history is when we are looking at the start of modern veterinary medicine?
I think so, yes. I mean, I regard it as probably the most important defining moment in veterinary history. At last, the treatment of animals became a specialized part of pathology. Veterinary medicine became a separate discipline.
And so the age of modern veterinary medicine had begun. Join us in the next episode of the Vet Podcast when Bruce discusses the development of modern veterinary medicine. Once again, a big thank you to 5M Books for supplying me Bruce's book. If you would like a copy of your own or one of the other titles in their catalogue of books covering veterinary and animal science, aquaculture and agriculture, visit 5mbooks.com. Talk again soon. And that's it for another episode of the Vet Podcast. All of our links are in one place at beacons.ai/vetpodcast. That is beacons.ai/vetpodcast. And while you're there, don't forget to buy us a coffee. On behalf of me, Brian Greger, and everybody else involved in the making of this podcast, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you again soon.